Retirement Committee, Wednesday, January 10th, will come to order. Our first presentation is to view part two of A History of the Land, Changes in the Land. We can go ahead and start that.
The McKnight Foundation, maintaining and restoring a healthy, sustainable environment in the Mississippi River Basin. And these funding partners. In the late 1840s, surveyors working for the U.S. Land Office Survey began the long process of measuring section lines to help facilitate the rapid sale of Minnesota land to settlers. Their arrival marked the beginning of monumental change for the natural landscape. A surge of white settlement was about to make a new world of the old. Loggers were already cutting white pine and thorns. Now farms began appearing in the wooded openings across the southeast in the wake of the survey crews. Soon the prairie would fill with new settlers too. Wealth would pour into and from Minnesota. World renown would come to the booming city built on the falls of St. Anthony. Described by the surveyors, the prairies, the deciduous woodlands, the conifer forest, and even rivers and streams would be changed forever. In 1849, there were fewer than 6,000 white citizens in all of the Minnesota Territory. But in the 1850s, white settlers began flooding into the region. Europeans joined Yankees in a bid to make new lives for themselves and their families. Most came to farm, but lumberers, merchants, and town builders all found parts of southeastern Minnesota to lie. Territory.
It's not a prairie.
Neither is it timber.
Nor yet is it open. It's
such, like we call openings in other places. There is plenty of large, heavy timber. Maple, oak,
ash.
Reverend H.M. Nichols, 1855. The landscape in which these newcomers were settling was, in fact, the western end of a vast forest ecosystem that stretched across the eastern United States to the Atlantic Ocean.
By the time settlers arrived, the eastern part of the United States was densely forested, and in an apocryphal saying, it was said that a squirrel could start at Manhattan and go all the way to the Mississippi River without ever touching ground, just living from tree to
swinging from branch to branch, huh?
Branch.
In Minnesota, that forest expressed itself in a narrow types that cut diagonally across the state. squeezed between fires coming off the dry prairies to the west and the cool weather conditions to the northeast, they included aspen parklands, oak savannas, and mixed forests of oak, elm, maple, and basswood. Perhaps the most impressive part of this extended ecosystem was a huge block of forest, more than 3,000 square miles in extent, known simply as the Big Woods. Joseph Nicolay, surveying the region in the fall of 1838, recorded his astonishment upon encountering them. We entered the high timbered parts of red and white oaks, white and sugar maples, and black walnut. Here to be found in a perfection and health and size which is not to compare with any of the timber at the Minnesota or Mississippi rivers. We had to cut a road through this magnificent and valuable wood. Some 90% gone now, only fragments of the original Big Woods remain. Like the forest here at Nurse Strand Park near Northfield. Here, the particular rhythms and habitat of this forest type are preserved.
The Big Woods is really a place that is defined by shade and what shade does to the life around it. Because the only thing that can survive on that forest floor in shade are those species that are the Big Woods type. The maple, the basswood. It is because of that shade that that forest can perpetuate itself over time. In the springtime, you have these wildflowers that are called ephemerals that are rushing to bloom before that canopy of leaves closes overhead and drops the forest floor into darkness.
The dense canopy of the Big Woods provides habitat for a variety of migratory birds. Tiny, colorful, flitting from branch to branch, birds like the red-eyed vireo are sometimes described as the butterflies of the bird world.
This little bird weighs less than a pack of gum, but every year it migrates 3,800 miles from the Amazon River Basin in South America to this block of forest in Minnesota, where it'll build its nest made of little bits of bark and grass held together by spider silk. Now you think of that bird's entire rhythm of life is based on the characteristics of this forest. And there are many animals like that. There are many birds like that, for example, that require large areas of interior forest habitat to be able to reproduce successfully.
Don't they have any better working DVD players?
The Big Woods. The larger forest ecosystem of which it was a part was rich in wildlife, but much to offer the settlers. Hewing close to the rivers, these newcomers moved up through the deciduous forest belt, occupying land along the forest's edges and prairie openings. Although most settlers didn't know it, this landscape that so attracted them been shaped by humans in significant ways for thousands of years.
The region had been occupied for millennia by a number of different groups, the most recent of which was the Dakota, who had settled in areas that appealed to them. What drew the Dakota to the landscape is the same thing that attracted settlers. We have basic human needs for fresh water, trees, which would provide fuel and shelter from the winds, game, and openings. The Dakota planted their gardens along along the river bottoms. One of the stereotypes about the Dakota people is that we were simply nomads, that we migrated around and never settled in any one place, never did any farming. The Dakota did indeed farm and had some planting villages that they would not only come back to in the summer, but repeatedly year after year. The farming was just one aspect of our lives, but it wasn't the sole resource.
But for European American settlers, farming was a full-time occupation. Many saw the Indian subsistence lifestyle as primitive and wasteful of resources. This was used as a justification for taking the land through treaties.
Once the treaties had been signed, Euro American settlers came into the region and directly occupied those places that had just been vacated by the Dakota. Came in and took over village sites and took over fields that the Dakota had cleared for their corn crops and planted Euro-American varieties of corn.
Along with new varieties of corn, European Americans brought with them a new way of looking at the land. For them, its highest and best use was farming. The woods would have to go.
They came to the forests. Wonderful accounts of how stunning the trees were, the size and beauty of the forests that they encountered, and their richness in terms of game and so forth. But no one questioned the necessity of cutting those trees. The trees were there to be put to use. They were cut, they were put to use, and the land in turn was then viewed as a resource for subsequent activities once the trees were gone, in the pattern that had been repeated over and over and over again as Americans moved west.
As it now stood, covered with timber, it was not furnishing anyone with anything, not even pasture. Timber and mosquitoes was all it would raise till cut off. Then it would furnish at least 20 bushels of wheat for every acre. G.W. Allen.
Almost unimaginable the amount of labor it took and why it can take so many years to get 4 or 5 or 6 or 10 acres of cleared land. The back-breaking labor of grubbing, pulling out stuff.
A tremendous amount of physical labor
by mostly men and boys.
Chopping.
The first wood that was cut in this area was open, and it was really for local purposes. They wanted building material and they wanted fuel. But when the railroad reached Faribault from the north, they had this sudden access to markets that they hadn't been able to reach before.
Millions of board feet. But much of the woods was simply burned to clear the land for farming. By the end of the 19th century, most of this 3,000 square mile forest had vanished. In its place was now a landscape that mirrored the landscapes of the world the settlers had left behind. A landscape of farms and towns and shelter belts of imported trees and shrubs that followed the grid lines that now define the new order.
Thank you.
the late 1850s, the removal of those old parts of the landscape that were incompatible with the new sped up dramatically. The hunt for fur bearers that had fueled the old Indian-based fur trade was now extended to the rest of the region's wildlife on a scale that would dwarf that former trade.
There is the legend, in a way, the myth that the fur trade ended in this area because the animals were wiped out. That was not true. The animals were still there.
And in numbers that are hard to imagine.
Before civilization makes the game scarce. Roseau County Times, April 1866.
Hunting and trapping that had been done mainly by Indians and settlers to feed and support themselves now became an industry. Key to that transformation were the railroads.
With the building of the railroads, suddenly there's a national market where before there had been a local. I mean, there had always been a market, but it's suddenly a national market in which the game is pulled to the area in which the highest price would be paid, which is in the East. In the old days, it would have taken weeks or months to get to the East Coast, and now it was possible to ship this meat to the East Coast in days.
Exploding markets. A new species, the professional market hunter. Paid by the piece, they hunted nearly anything that moved.
Almost every game animal that could be hunted in Minnesota was in demand in the East. Everything from moose and deer and elk to grouse and pigeons and prairie chickens were in demand and could be served in Delmonico's in New York City or any fancy restaurant.
With advances in equipment, the uncontrolled take became a slaughter. Bear tallow and prairie chickens were shipped by the barrel. Buffalo robes by the bale. Perhaps no creature more aptly symbolizes this period of wastefulness than the now extinct passenger pigeon. A species of the eastern deciduous forest, the birds were estimated to have numbered as many as 3 to 5 billion individuals. Traveling in flocks of sometimes more than a million birds, presence on the land. Destructive to grain fields, easy to kill, and tasty to eat, the pigeons were slaughtered in the millions. Pigeon hunters, using telegraphs to follow the birds wherever they congregated, became a specialized branch of market hunting. By 1900, the birds, unable to find safe nesting areas, had vanished from the wild.
For many people in the 19th century, there was simply no sense that game animals were endangered in any way. Because, especially in places like Minnesota, they appeared to be plentiful. And so individual people would have no sense of the larger health of the population of animals and would continue to make decisions based on that assumption.
In fewer than 50 years, the one species that had entered the era with perhaps the greatest population of all had dwindled to a single surviving bird. The
passenger pigeon was held captive by the Cincinnati Zoological Society. It died on September 1st, 1914.
I want you to notice how it's drying out here a little bit. This is probably sandier stuff here.
Richard Pemble teaches biology at Morehead State University. And today, this is his classroom.
Up on those ridges.
The Blue Stem Prairie Preserve is a 3,500-acre remnant of tall grass prairie, located some 10 miles east of Fargo-Moorhead.
Lots of stuff going on out here. Let's kind of wander here.
Campbell brings his students here to show them what a prairie is, and more important, to engage their imaginations about what the prairie used to be.
You need to see it in the prairie. You need to sit in a place like this. Now, what I want you to do, I want you to lay back. Okay? Lay back. You don't see anybody. Now, do you see anybody? Now, what was this place like at the time that the Europeans first came into it, saw this prairie firsthand? What did they see? One of the very early descriptions came from an English trader. A fellow by the name of Alexander Henry. September the 5th, 1800. Henry writes that we found immense herds of buffalo, which appeared to touch the river and extend westward on the plains as far as the eye could reach. The meadows were alive with them. Can you imagine squinting, looking as far as you could see, and see bison?
Over that last rise, and ahead of you is just literally a sea of grass, as far as you can see.
Newcomers to the region have never seen a landscape quite like the prairie.
grass and flowers
stretched around me,
rising and falling in gentle undulations. We passed full acres of blossoms, all bearing one hue, purple perhaps, or masses of yellow or rose. And then again, a carpet of every color intermixed, as if a rainbow had fallen among the slopes. Eliza Steele, June 1, 1840.
Here in Minnesota, tall grass prairie blanketed the western part of the state, part of the grassland that stretched unbroken to the Rocky Mountains. Though often compared to an ocean, the metaphor wasn't quite precise. The prairie was a remarkably diverse mix of plants, animals, and other organisms.
A complex web of life.
I like to use the patchwork quilt idea that here it's this, and over here it's something different. And our prairies were like that. And you can see the big blue stem with the grasses 4 or 5 feet tall, dominating what we call a music prairie. As we walk down in this particular place, it's a depression in the landscape, getting wetter, soil's getting wetter. I can feel it under my feet, but I know it from the plants because I can see here plants that are, we lose the big blue stem. This would be more wet prairie in here. Walk a few feet further, and I leave the prairie cordgrass and the reed canary grass. Now I'm in cattails, and I'm in a marsh. And all this change happened in 20 feet. Because the topography changed a little bit.
Because most of it now is farmland, it's hard to capture the grandeur and scale of the pre-settlement. Few small patches of virgin prairie remain, like this 100-acre parcel on the Tony Thompson farm near Windham.
There are maybe as many as 250 species, maybe more, of plants alone in this particular piece. piece of tallgrass prairie. What is unusual about this piece of prairie is that it could so easily have been converted to cultivated agriculture, and it wasn't.
Tony Thompson is a fifth-generation farmer. He feels a special connection to this piece of prairie, spared the plow by his great aunt.
This is 100 acres that is sitting on top of an ideal soil for farming. It has a beautiful little wetland in it that could easily have been drained long ago. She didn't have the heart, as I understand, to drain this wetland. She saw her last curlew there.
Imagine 20,000 square miles of this. It's just unbelievable. It's hard to comprehend.
Prairie remnants like Thompson's and the Bluestem Preserve can offer a glimpse into one of the defining characteristics of prairies, their amazing biological diversity.
Here is a liat, a species that's common in prairie plant landscaping now.
This is called green needlegrass. Tends to pick out dire sites. We should find some needles. There's one. Why don't you grab that one with the needle?
This is lead plant. It's one of the plants that tends to be a little bit wooden.
This is a relative of the green needlegrass. This is called needle and thread. Doesn't it look like thread and needle?
Here is one of the most characteristic wildflowers, green-headed coneflower, prairie coneflower.
This is a leaving primrose.
The genus is Pedicularis, and here we see a scattering of it.
Sage or some other species. And it's just like being out in the Dakotas.
The diversity of the plants was matched by a diversity of other organisms.
The wildlife of the prairie would have been a very rich mix of species. It would have included everything from large predators like the grizzly bear and the timber wolf to large grazers like bison that lived in extremely large numbers across the prairie, elk, which were naturally a grazing species, they were a prairie species, waterfowl in just untold numbers and variety of species. It would have been literally a very different place than it is now, just teeming.
Fire was essential to maintain the prairie.
The prairie dries out. The vast, unbroken expanse of fuel flying out there for miles and miles. Lightning strikes, Native American people starting the prairie on fire on purpose. And they did it because they knew that the prairies would benefit from fire. They can remove the accumulation of dead vegetation, expose the soil to the warming rays of the sun in the spring, things warm up, things get going faster, and the prairie flourishes with fire.
Bison were also crucial to the health of this ecosystem.
Some of the experts have called them mowing machines. You ever heard of 1,000, 2,000, or millions like Colonel Dodge used to see when he first came across the plains? When they came across, they just mowed it down.
The bison as grazers actually played a critical role in the prairie. Without the bison, without the grazers, there's an accumulation of plant material on the surface that ties up nutrients. It prevents the sun from reaching the soil surface. The soil stays cool. The plants don't get started. The prairie suffers.
American settlers trying to eke out a living on the prairie had little interest in what we now call biological diversity.
When people came first to the prairies, they recognized the beauty of the prairies. But at the very same time that they admired this as a natural wonder, they recognized a higher necessity of plowing it, of making it into rectangular farm fields and into productive land, which was seen to be a higher and a better use in the 19th century.
Minnesota's first governor, Alexander Ramsey, captured the essence of this sensibility in his 1860 inaugural address.
Give us the capital of more men, of more people, and we will vivify, infuse the breath of life into the dead capital of millions of acres now growing only prairie flowers.
Ramsey's dead capital. The world beneath the prairie flowers was very much alive.
By some estimates, as much as 90%
of the prairie biomass,
the living part of the landscape,
was underground. A single square yard of big blue stem grass could contain 25 miles of roots. Those roots were food for billions of microbes and insects. Died back each year. They converted plant material into compost that, when mixed with minerals left by the glaciers, created nutrient-rich soil.
It's a very young soil in these systems. It's only 10,000 years old or 12,000 years old. It's only been in existence since the last ice age. Many soils of the world are much older than this, up to 5 million years old. They're old and they're highly weathered and they don't contain many. This soil in this basin is ideally suited for agriculture.
But the prairie presented settlers with a problem.
Well, having never broken prairie myself yet, reading accounts, it's a tremendous, physically draining process. Even in the sand, farmers are using 2 to 3 teams of oxen to cut that first sod. And this is prairie that's been here for thousands of years in some cases. And so the buildup of root material and dry matter and the longevity of some of these prairie plants are giving a tremendous root to try and cut through.
The problem of cutting this thick mat of roots was solved by an Illinois blacksmith. John Deere. His invention, a sharp steel moldboard and chair, became known as the singing plow because it emitted a slight whine as it sliced through the prairie's root mass.
This plow went right through the roots, cut it, overturned it, killed the plants, started the composting process, which released the nutrients. Without that technology, prairies would not have been exploited at that time.
Exploiting the prairie meant killing it. The plow severed the prairie roots, cutting off the nutrient production process that made the soil so rich.
The hundreds of species that had made up the
prairie's working parts were now replaced by just one. Imported grass called wheat.
Wheat growing in Minnesota really starts to take off in the latter 1850s, and especially during the 1860s. Because the Civil War has created a tremendous demand for wheat. And wheat is the only crop you can move to market effectively. Corn can only be moved on the hoof of a hog or in a whiskey jug. But wheat is the cash crop. It's the one that will give you money. And if it's the only thing you can raise that will generate money, it is in some sense that lottery ticket. It's the lottery. I'm going to make it rich on wheat.
Critical to the spread of wheat and the consequent plow of the prairies after the Civil War. Spreading across the land, they brought a steady stream of farmers out on the prairie. And later, their their produce back to the growing urban markets.
But with the railroads, space no longer mattered so much. You could move across land far more quickly, connect distant points much more closely, and do it through the lens of corporations whose goal it was to rearrange the entire landscape.
I just want everybody to understand that the people who were out here in the frontier period didn't think of themselves at the end of the world. They saw themselves standing on a gold mine, and all they had to do was stitch this resource frontier together with the markets in the east, and everybody would live happily ever after.
Well, we see the tremendous demise of prairie land. We see a rapid decrease of wildlands, and the tremendous amount of farmland that's going under production. It is wheat with smaller plots of anything else. We start landmining, if you will, for wheat.
That process was no better expressed than on the prairies of the Red River Valley. Here on the former floor of what was once the world's greatest glacial lake, Lake Agassiz, was a landscape seemingly made for the industrial model. Devoid of trees and lakes and cut by few rivers, the valley's deep black prairie soils seemed to beckon farming on a massive scale. Much of the valley was owned by the Northern Pacific Railroad. When the company went bankrupt in 1873, these lands became available at fire sale prices.
And the result of that bankruptcy was the creation of an era in American farming called the Bonanza Farms.
Farms of 1,000 or more acres sprung up on the valley on lands previously owned by the railroad, financed by big money investors. These were farms managed by corporations, employing hundreds of unskilled workers and fleets of giant reapers. Operations that created agriculture on a scale never seen before in the country.
This was large-scale agriculture, mechanized, but it was horse-drawn mechanization. A whole day moving from one end to the other, cutting wheat and then turning around and coming back the next swath.
And the result was a deluge of wheat into the city of Minneapolis. Keeping pace with the changes in agricultural production were the changes in the way that wheat was processed.
And with that concentration of that crop, it became economic for flour mills in Minneapolis to invest in new technologies borrowed from Central Europe for rolling mills, for middling purifiers, to change the whole way that flour was milled, not just in Minnesota, but in the whole country.
They were now able at St. Anthony Falls to produce flour of the highest quality the world had ever seen, in quantities the world had never seen. This combination of quality and quantity meant that we industrialized the product of flour. For the first time in history, we were treating food as an industrial product. By the middle of the 1880s, we were exporting 35% of it internationally. Buy a barrel of flour made in Minneapolis in Turkey than it was to buy a barrel of flour made in Turkey.
Run through the mills at St. Anthony Falls, wheat had turned Minnesota into a commodities giant. Names like Pillsbury, gold medal flour, were known throughout the world, and the capital they generated fueled the growth, wealth, and power of a growing metropolis. But it was an empire that wheat alone could not sustain.
Eventually, wheat diseases, the rusts and whatnot,
get to be more and more of a problem. Weeds became a problem, some insects as well, but primarily crop diseases.
By the 1890s, repeated plantings of wheat were clearly draining the soil of nutrients. Falling yields and a glut of wheat streaming out of the prairies to the west finally brought the heyday of wheat to a close. Already farmers were turning to corn and oats. In Minnesota, commodity agriculture would survive, but the industrial model clearly had consequences.
We came in and used the fertile prairie soils in Minnesota. We planted wheat, this crop that didn't even occur in North America, brought it with us from Europe over here. Planted it, were able to grow it across the land with bountiful harvests, built wealth, built cities, and everything else. We were using nature. A lot of benefits, some costs. What we do in our modern culture is favor those species that are useful to us, whether it's wheat for food, or corn for food, or bluegrass as a turf. We favor what are called monocultures. In contrast, a prairie is not a monoculture. A prairie is a community. It's a diverse community. Learned in looking at how diversity affects the functioning of systems is that when systems are simplified, systems tend to lose productivity, they lose fertility of their soil, and they become less stable, less sustainable through time.
Before the 19th century was through, the prairie was effectively gone.
A third of the state was grassland. 20,000 square miles of Minnesota was grassland. And 20,000 square miles today is agricultural land. And that conversion occurred very, very rapidly. So 20 square miles, perhaps 30 square miles, and little isolated fragments remain, a tenth of a percent, less than 1%, certainly. It's hard to know a landscape when that's all that remains of it. We can go see forests because the forests exist, even if they've been cut over, impacted by people, but the prairie's gone.
Prairie went all the other things it was. Blue stem, wolves, fire, elk, and of course bison. Hunted out of Minnesota by the 1850s, it was nearly extinct by the end of the 19th century. Only the bones of the animals remain, literally carbonating the empty. The bison, once so valuable to the prairie and then to the hide market, now became something else, a rich source of fertilizer. Whole families made their livings gathering the bones. Like the prairie, of which it was a vital part, the bison was incompatible with the emerging world that was replacing it. It was only in death that both the bison and the prairie became a valued part of the new landscape.
Quantity of snow that has fallen since I wrote last
has come also an increased amount of business.
Quite a number of teams of men are being added to this camp, which with plenty of snow makes things go rather lively.
It is only
about 3 weeks ago that we got hauling.
By tomorrow night, we'll have a little more than 2.5 million feet banked, and
still rolling them at a rate of 100,000 feet per day. Lumbermen, Stillwater Gazette, January 12th, 1877.
From its earliest days in Minnesota into the last quarter of the 19th century, the logging business in the state had grown from small operations centered around the river valleys of the St. Croix, the Rum, and the Mississippi, to a giant industry. By 1878, Minnesota was producing nearly 200 million board feet of lumber, enough to encircle the earth more than once, and every year saw an increase. As the acreage of devastated forest grew, voices of alarm began to be heard. Lonely, isolated, our forests are falling with appalling rapidity. Like spendthrifts, we are living not upon the interest, but upon the capital. Carl Schurz, Secretary of the Interior, 1881. But out on the frontier, there was still too much forest left, too much money to be made for such concerns to slow the escalating. Steam power was commonplace. New steel band saws made a speedier, more efficient cut. And just as railroads were spreading across all of Minnesota, they also began penetrating into the North Woods, heading right to the cut itself. So no longer were lumbermen dependent upon driving unpredictable streams and rivers down to their saws. Rails, and what that did is that this moving industry faster and faster.
The woods are becoming very much like a factory,
and I think that's how many people would conceive of these woods and in fact these vast forests as yet another factory that can be mechanized in the process of which you generate far more board feet than you could have by the ordinary mechanisms of individuals with axes taking down trees one by one.
As logging operations were becoming more industrialized in Minnesota, the pineries in other Great Lakes states were showing signs of depletion. Lumber barons soon set their sights on the forests west of Duluth. By 80, they had purchased vast tracts of the rich pineries at pennies an acre, principally by manipulating the land laws aimed at making agricultural land available to settlers.
The key in making large profit, of course, was to lower your overhead. To make sure you didn't pay top dollar or even medium dollar for the land, and in fact, if you could steal it, all to the good.
And steal it they did. In 1879, federal trespass suits were brought against 79 Minnesota lumbermen, a virtual who's who of the Minneapolis lumber industry. The event was noteworthy not so much because of the people involved, but because legal action was brought at all. Most people thought the not only by providing lumber to the nation, but by clearing woods for settlers and agriculture.
Land that was wild was not profitable, it was underutilized, and it could only be best used if it was civilized. The plow always followed the axe.
Lumber companies, land speculators, frontier boosters, and even the University of so does Agricultural Extension Service, all tenaciously promoted the cutover as farmland. But the northern forest ecosystem, so efficient at growing pine trees, was not suited to agriculture. The soils were thin, acidic, and poor in nutrients. What's more, intensive logging had left behind a devastated landscape that was a tinderbox ready to explode.
What would happen when you went through a logging area where there was a variety of down slash from the tree branches and the tree needles? Once they dried, they were very volatile. All spark, and they were up in flames.
Fire had always been an important part of the ecosystem. Occurring in patches, it was the way the forest renewed itself. But now there were hundreds of square miles of cutover land. The slash left behind by loggers fueled catastrophic fires. These had disastrous consequences for the white pine.
It's a little unfair to blame the demise of white pine in this particular area on logging alone. White pines in older stands almost always have a seedling bank or a bank of saplings that are ready to take over and grow once the parent trees are removed. But they had so many fires that were so hot burning through this old slash that the white pine simply couldn't reproduce or produce enough seeds to regenerate. We killed the parents with the axe, and we came back and wiped out the progeny with fires.
Enticed by the availability of cheap cutover land, settlers and townsite boomers and others began moving into the area. It was only a matter of time before a major catastrophe occurred. That happened on September 1st, 1894. Minnesota, population 680, was a mill town that occupied what one resident described as a hole cut into the brush.
So many lumber companies did come into this area. We had probably 10, right, in the heyday of the logging industry that came in here and just really clear-cut the entire area. And so Hinckley, by the time the fire came along, was really almost a prairie, because the trees in the immediate area were gone.
September 1st dawned hot and dry. A fire erupted in the woods southwest of town. Fueled by slash and a mix of humid air near the ground and colder air above, a fire exploded.
Started funneling down and turning it into a cyclone or a tornado, a fire.
Firestorms swept toward Hinckley at an incredible speed.
People just had run for their lives. It was traveling at some points even at 75 miles an hour. It measured about 4.5 miles into the atmosphere. By about 4 o'clock, the entire town of Hinckley was consumed. There was not much left after it was over. And so people who went through that fire thought it was really the end of the world.
Square miles was burned in a 30-mile-wide path swept across Pine County. The heat was so intense that railroad spikes and rails were bent.
For nearly 50 years, Minnesota's lumbermen had had a free hand in taking what they wanted, manipulating the rules to suit their needs. The few voices who questioned the practice of the loggers had been drowned by those applauding the commerce they brought to the state. Now, the ghosts of Hinckley were also crying for reform. In a span of roughly 50 years, the time of the land survey, until the dawn of the 20th century, Minnesota's landscapes had been remade by human hands.
example of the railroads in the elimination of the region's wildlife by market hunters. The prairie, with all its diversity of plants and animals, have been vastly simplified. And now the white pine forest was gone. Turned into houses. The scale and accelerated rate of these changes were unprecedented in history. It took a disaster to sound the alarm. From out of the ashes of Hinckley came a freshening breeze, a reform movement that had percolated throughout much of the latter half of the 19th century suddenly had new conflict. Led by a crusading old Civil War hero by the name of Christopher Columbus Andrews, culminate in an entirely new way that the people of Minnesota viewed their landscapes.
Any comments now that we've seen the first two parts of that, Senator? Well,
Mr. Chairman, I just have a couple comments I'd share with the committee. If you're interested in seeing Dakota Gardens, that are Dakota-type farming, and that was referenced in one of the early sessions, at the Lower Sioux Interpretive Center in Redwood County, at the Lower Sioux community, the Historical Society plants corn as a Dakota would have planted them. And essentially, they planted them in hills quite widely spaced and then planted a viney crop around them, like squash, I believe it was. And, of course, they would go follow their hunting and trapping and come back weeks, maybe months later, and the corn would have grown and matured and the viney crops would have kept the weeds or the non-corn from growing up and competing with the corn. And that's the way they grew the corn. And the other comment I made that jogged my memory a little bit, this last June I was up at the Big Bog Recreation Area for the ribbon cutting and grand opening of the Big Bog walk access onto the Big Bog north of Red Lake. It's was opened this June, and it goes out into the bog over a mile, about a mile and a quarter. But one of the placards along that aluminum walk is a placard detailing the last caribou herd in Minnesota. And it was at Upper Red Lake, and it's right near Senator Stump's district. I learned when I was going to go up there and looking for a direction, it's actually in Senator Scoy's district. But there was a wild caribou herd in Minnesota into the 1930s. And the Department of Natural Resources knew that the last herd was north of Upper Red Lake. And they tried to perpetuate the herd, but they think the last animal died somewhere around 1940, as I recalled. But I did not realize until then that there was caribou in Minnesota, and it was referenced in one of these sessions.
Thank you. Anything else? Continuing with the agenda, we welcome Dave Shad here, Director of Fish and Wildlife, part of our presentation today on Working the Land Initiative from the Department of Natural Resources. Mr. Shad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. With me today I have Ray Norgaard. Ray works with Wetland Wildlife Programs in the Division of Fish and Wildlife. And what we wanted to talk a little bit was about kind of a new approach to doing conservation work out in the prairie landscape of Minnesota. You know, the impacts to the prairies that were documented in the TV program here today aren't new. And as a result of that, and they've actually had very profound impacts on natural resources in that part of the state. And as a result of that, over time, there have been a lot of programs, a lot of initiatives, both by government agencies and by the private sector, to try to put some of that wetland and grassland back on the land. The problem is that those programs haven't been real effective, in part because they haven't been well coordinated, A lot of that work has been kind of scattergunned across the land rather than focused where it can do the most good and where it's most appropriate. And in many cases, some of these programs have unnecessarily pitted farmers against conservation interests. And so we thought we needed to kind of take a look at a different approach, a different way of doing business out in that part of the state. What Working Lands is intended to do is to bring all the partners that have an interest in doing conservation work out in the prairies together, including agricultural interests, and try to work a little bit smarter. What we're trying to do is to try to focus the work where we can get benefits to wildlife, to water quality, and to many different resources on those same acres. So in essence, we can get more conservation work done on fewer acres and for less cost. We also want to work on both public and private lands. Working Lands isn't just about going out and buying wildlife management areas or waterfowl protection areas or that kind of thing. The key to actually doing better conservation work is using all the tools and especially working with private landowners and those interested in incorporating conservation measures into their operations to try to achieve what we want to do for conservation. As you'll see, I think also this Working Lands model has real relevance to some of the energy issues and the cellulosic ethanol and the need to look to develop grass fiber for energy here in the state. So we think this is really a relevant topic, and we appreciate the opportunity to present some information. So with that, I'll turn it over to Ray, and he'll walk you through some additional detail on the program.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you, members of the committee, for this opportunity. The Working Lands Initiative got its start in about 2005. It began with a group of agency folks and nonprofit organizations like Pheasants Forever and Ducks Unlimited getting together and talking about some conservation issues, and has grown since to 11 members, and we expect that group to expand even further. The initial goal of that discussion group was the conservation of prairie, wetland, and grassland habitat. So initially, it's focused very much on the prairie. And the group members recognize that although there are a lot of building blocks for cooperative conservation out within our agencies, within our organizations, that in a lot of cases that they're within those organizations, they're not always available to partners. They're not even, other partners aren't even aware of what's available. That can include research, mapping information, in some cases even funding. Also, the really important part of what is recognized by this group is that no single organization, agency, or individual can do this job. And if we don't work together, it's going to be impossible to accomplish. And so it's imperative that they work together to establish a set of shared goals, looking at the landscape that includes fish and wildlife, clean water, flood damage, energy, and agriculture. In recognizing those needs, we felt it was important, and this is, again, looking at the variety of groups that are represented in this discussion group, that first of all, to make a commitment at all levels in the organization that this is the direction we want to go in terms of a cooperative approach to conservation. And secondly, the really critical need that there's involvement, across interest groups, from agriculture to nonprofit groups, private landowners, and resource agencies. So the goal is to develop this kind of shared vision for wetland and grassland conservation. The thing that was new about it is that they're looking at applying ecological models, taking the best science that we have, linking that science with geographic information systems in order to get us further down the road. And a way to think about it in very simple terms is just simply it's looking at doing the best job we can to do the right things in the right places. The framework from a kind of a wildlife perspective initially here is that you look at what you have for a population objective, statewide or within a particular region. You can look at the science and figure out what kind of habitat you need to accomplish that. You can look further at the science and use and link it with GIS systems to kind of figure out how it should look on the landscape. And using those two things together, that provides the information that you can use for discussion. So you can talk about what's really going to go on in the landscape, decide and have issues and discussions about where it should go on and how you're going to accomplish it. we look specifically at waterfall, which is what I work primarily with, we can just run through a quick example of how this might work. And we all know that wetlands are really important for ducks, but the relationship is so specific that you can, in fact, have a mathematical equation for predicting how many duck pairs are going to be within a particular area. And the thing to point out is on the left-hand side of the screen here is a critical importance of temporary and seasonal wetlands as a part of that equation. We can look at what it looks like on the landscape, and in most cases, you know, we have a variety of wetland types there. In this case, the light yellow and the gold temporary and seasonal basins all the way to the semi-permanent and permanent basins. We can also look as an example of a mallard hen, you know, how she relates to this particular landscape. From her focus area, where her primary breeding area is, she will range out about 2 miles to look for the best food, the best area to nest in, the area where, you know, she's going to be raising her brood, where she'll molt, and the habitat has to fit those needs through that entire period. So that, again, the temporary and seasonal wetlands being absolutely critical in the spring from a food and a breeding standpoint, grasslands being important for nesting, and more permanent wetlands for brood cover and for fall migration. We can also look at the science in terms of, you know, what are really the most important factors when we're looking at those mallard populations. You know, and research can show us that if we really want to make a difference in duck populations, hen and nest survival are really the critical factors on the prairie. They are absolutely the most important, represented by the tall bar here on the left-hand side. And the key to nest success is grasslands. So we have to begin to create this picture of wetlands and grasslands working together to improve duck populations. You put all that together, you apply the science, and you ask yourself, what's it going to take to produce ducks in the landscape? Well, it's going to take a habitat complex at least 4 square miles in size that relates to that home range of that hen mallard, 20% of the area in wetlands, and half of that temporary and seasonal wetlands, 40% of the area in grassland cover, and half of that under some kind of long-term protection. If we link that to a geographic information system, we can do things like map duck abundance, the duck pair abundance, and we can see in the Prairie Pothole region of Minnesota, you know, where do we have the most duck pairs as a way of targeting where we might want to have the most grasslands. We can use it to take a more efficient look at what we're doing with our dollars and where we're putting habitat on the ground. On the right-hand side of the screen is this hypothetical example of if we just took lands that were available without any kind of targeting at all, it would take about 113,000 acres to raise an additional 4,000 ducks. But if we target those acres to those complexes, linking the wetlands and the grasslands together, we can take 25% less land, we can raise 75% more birds. So it's a way of really making what we're doing much more efficient. Go back to the duck example in that framework. The Department of Natural Resources in their duck plan has an objective of 1 million breeding ducks. We know that that's going to take about 2 million acres of additional wetlands and grassland habitat if, on a landscape, it's put together in terms of complexes. And we can describe where the highest probability of creating those complexes is using GIS systems. And we can take those tools together to sit down with other interest groups, whether it be Pheasants Forever or the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association or Farmers Union, and talk about where does it make the most sense, you know, to target our efforts. We can do the same thing for non-game birds. We can do the same thing for pheasants. We can do the same thing for deer. And by using these GIS systems, we can begin to create, you know, a map that brings together a larger group of interest groups and prioritizing where the most important work should occur. And, in fact, we used a map very much like this in the discussions with the Wetland Reserve Program under USDA. Prior to 2005, if you were within the Prairie Pothole region, you were a landowner making an application, you got 20 additional points for wildlife value. If you were within the Prairie Pothole region, you got 0 if you were outside. And by applying the science, we can see that there are areas within the Prairie Pothole region which are not going to be as productive from a duck standpoint or a wildlife standpoint. And there are other areas that have a higher value. So we're really fine-tuning how those points were awarded to those applications. We're doing the same thing under the new a USDA program called Conservation Practice 37. That's designed specifically for wetland grassland complexes within the Prairie Pothole region with a cap of 100,000 acres. 8,000 acres have been allocated for Minnesota. You know, although the specific priority map hasn't been released by FSA yet, it will look very similar to the layout, what the layout is here for the Wetland Reserve Program. Just look at what it might look like on the ground. In 1995, this is a portion of Western Township just southwest of Fergus Falls, Minnesota. You can see that there's a scientific and natural area. There's a waterfall production area. There's a couple of small wildlife management areas. This is an absolutely rich area from the potential from a wildlife standpoint. And by applying some of these same principles, working together with local partners, this is what that area looks like in 2006. You know, those are all wetland grassland areas. Now, they're not all waterfall production areas or wildlife management areas. As Dave mentioned, it's, you know, we think it's really critical working with private landowners. This includes lands purchased by the local fishing game club, Fergus Falls Fishing Game Club, landowners that are working with Pheasants Forever. There's rim easements here, there's grassland easements, and there's wetland easements. So it's a combination of tools that were applied to this area to really make it productive from a wildlife standpoint. 61% of the land here in these 12 square miles is still in active agriculture, and a significantly larger portion of that is still in private ownership. So again, it's that public-private partnership to move things forward. Wildlife is one aspect of it. You know, we also think it's important to be looking at flooding, at water quality issues, and also at energy issues. From a flooding standpoint, I'm just going to show one example here. On the left-hand side of the screen with the red lettering is an example of the landscape in the south branch of the Buffalo River in the Red River Valley. On the right-hand side is an example of the landscape upstream of Orwell Dam near Fergus Falls. On the Buffalo River watershed, we have less than 2% of the wetlands remaining. On the Otter Tail River upstream of Orwell, we have more than 25% remaining. And you can see the flood hydrograph. You know, in the spring where you don't have wetlands, you have a lot of flooding. Where you do have wetlands, you do. So again, it's a way of trying to bring this science to bear on what we're doing and targeting our efforts. We should be able to technically take information from a wildlife standpoint, be able to map the priority areas for that, map the priority areas from a floodwater retention standpoint, and map the priority areas from a water quality standpoint, and merge them together to take an approach on the land and reach agreement on where we should be working together as resource agencies with our private partners to get the best impact. I'm going to show you just a quick example here. From Sibley County, right near Green Isle, Minnesota. This is what it looked like in the 1980s. You have Lake Washington, which is a shallow lake with a lot of wildlife benefits. You have a wetland complex adjacent to it. You have one wildlife management area just outside of Green Isle. The Met Council issued a grant to the Minnesota Waterfowl Association and hired a young man named Tom Cooper, who put together a group of public and private partners to work on restoring wetlands to improve water quality for the metropolitan area. This is what that same area looked like in 2006. Now, it includes not just a wildlife management area, but a waterfall production area in green. But most important, we have in red and in the yellow easements with private landowners. So that land remained in private ownership, but is being managed for water quality benefits. In the light blue, private land, wetland restoration supported by the partners program through the Fish and Wildlife Service, and in the white, grassland restoration programs on private land supported by agreements with the partners program. So they made great headway in this area in creating a complex, again, using that public-private partnership and looking at a variety of benefits. The Working Lands Initiative Discussion Group was fortunate, and the department received $1.2 million for the 06-07 biennium to support this effort. And the first thing that they did was to make a decision to identify a suite of wildlife interests, native prairie tracts, and shallow lakes as kind of the basis for what they wanted to approach in developing and looking at complexes. by applying the science with this fleet of wildlife species and other interests, they made the decision that what was important was to have, again, habitat complexes. They differ slightly from what we'd look at just from a duck standpoint. They're 4 to 9 square miles in size. The wetland component is about the same. The grassland component is 40 to 60% grassland. And then within the pheasant range, they have a core wintering area for pheasants and a winter food plot. So that's the science they put together in terms of describing where they wanted to go as a group. They linked that with a GIS system to map out where was the highest probability of success in providing that kind of habitat complex. And then specifically identified focus groups that involved 12 counties, 11 focus areas, and established local teams of resource managers within each of those focus areas. Conservation organizations, state, federal, and local resource agencies like the Soil and Water Conservation District and DNR and Fish and Wildlife Service, NRCS, county commissioners, and landowners were also involved in this effort. Those local teams had the responsibility to identify specific target areas where they thought, and we had the highest probability of establishing these complexes. So this is an example from Big Stone County in Autry Township. You know, again, where they had looked at it and said, you know, looking at what our resources are, what we have on the ground, using our personal knowledge of what we have going on in this particular county, this is where we can make our best effort. And there are a number of target areas established. These local teams were asked to apply existing tools that range all the way from cost share programs for soil conservation techniques, typical farm programs like CRP and EQIP, protection programs, whether it's easements or outright acquisition, and restoration programs using the Partners for Wildlife program with the Fish and Wildlife Service, Wildlife Lake designation, working with the agencies and private landowners. And note that all of these programs are with willing landowners. All of them are voluntary in terms of involvement. We also asked them to keep an open mind, to look at other things that were on the horizon. What was going on with biofuels and biomass, carbon storage, controlled drainage systems, sustainable grazing systems, you know, the important role that can play in grasslands, new crops, and looking at perhaps refined tillage applications. And they developed project proposals. Those project proposals ranged all the way from what we might typically see for easement programs, like doing what we can do to improve signups with CREP programs, reinvest in Minnesota easements, acquisition. But they also included proposals for controlled drainage, exotic species control, again, sustainable grazing, alternative crops, and biomass production. $4.5 million in requests. And we could only fund about 25% of those. We're looking right now, we'll be going, you know, that stuff will be going into the ground this spring and summer. Most of the grants will be through local soil and water conservation districts. And then as we look to the future, this program, we really want to emphasize is that it's how critical it is to be able to apply that local expertise. Nobody knows what's going on better than the folks that are working on the ground within those local areas. You know, on the statewide level, we can help provide information. We can help provide some of the science. We can help provide funding, some of the GIS support. But the local expertise is what's really going to make this drive. The other thing is we need to look at ways that we can strengthen the water quality and energy components. You know, these are relatively new things to bring into the equation. We're looking forward to working closer with the Pollution Control Agency, for example, and with the Impaired Waters Program. And, of course, we're all familiar with what the opportunities are going to be coming up with on the energy side. You know, we need to think about expanding the geographic scope of this thing, you know, beyond our local focus areas, you know, and begin to look at where we can apply it in more areas. It's also going to be important that we look at ways to provide a diverse funding base. If we're really going to provide flexibility to these local teams, they can't be hamstrung by funds, you know, that are designed for a specific use. And so there has to be funds available to allow them to provide this wide range of tools on the ground. You know, and we also, you know, again, need to continue to look over the horizon, look at new approaches, new tools, new things that we can apply on that local level to make things work. in summary, I guess what I'd like you to remember is that, you know, this is the Working Lands Initiative is not a specific program. What it really is, it's kind of a new approach for us to work with our partners to bring a variety of interests together to move forward in the same direction. It's important to think about that, you know, that the focus is on complexes, not individual wetlands, not individual grass plots, not on some statewide level, but to look at how these complexes create synergy between habitat types, you know, and we have multiple benefits, including water quality benefits and energy benefits. Again, the importance that the priorities and the partners are locally driven. You know, what works in Big Stone County may not work in Pope County or may not work in Scott County. We're going to have a different set of partners, you know, potentially. We're going to have a different set of problems that we have to face. We're going to have different priorities. And it's important that we use those local interests to help identify those. And then lastly, it's important that, you know, again, that we find ways to reward innovation, you know, that we continue to move forward and look at new things. And, you know, that will require some diverse funding. But it also requires just encouragement on the part of those local teams that they should look for new things, you know, and not to hamstring them when they do that. Finally, questions or comments on this program should be directed to Dave Shad. Dave is the acting chair of this statewide discussion group. And I thank you for your attention. That concludes the presentation.
Thank you. I have a question. Might understand then that even like in the Lake Washington area, nothing was paid for those easements? Those were voluntarily?
No. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, that is not quite correct. Those easements were, you know, there was payment made for those easements, but the involvement of the landowner is voluntary. In other words, there was nothing that came down in terms of anything like eminent domain or local regulations that force those landowners to participate. They participated voluntarily, but you're absolutely correct that those easements were paid for. The payment schedule, of course, depends on the type of easement, and you know they're well established, whether it's a reinvested Minnesota easement or a Fish and Wildlife Service easement.
And then, you know, where I live, farmers and individual landowners like to think they're doing the right thing by leaving some wetland, leaving some crop behind. Are they not making much of an impact?
You know, I think it very much depends. It depends on the area. You know, when we look at the broad array of benefits that wetlands provide, you know, I think we can argue pretty effectively that any wetland provides benefits. You know, and any wetland's going to provide some wildlife benefits. But if we're really going to maximize our return on our investment, you know, then we need to look at how those things fit together within a complex. So, in the example that you cited, you know, what that landowner can do if they're interested in it from a wildlife standpoint is look beyond their farm, you know, in that area in the surrounding sections. What's going on there? What can be done to, you know, to work together with other landowners to bring that even to a higher level?
Senator Anderson, did you have a
Thank
question?
Thank you. Yeah. I'm wondering about the idea of energy production from some of these prairie grasses, wetland grasses. Do you have people have been asking a lot of questions about harvesting that and what the impact is on habitat, and I haven't really heard much in the way of answers. I mean, is that well researched, or is that just beginning to be looked at? You know, can we harvest those kinds of grasses once a year and not interfere with habitat, with the animal species that are there?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, you know, I think you're absolutely correct that we're pretty early in that process. Without, you know, having a good idea of all the impacts. But we can say this, I think. You know, there is a broad interest in doing that. You know, certainly the department has an interest in even providing opportunities in wildlife management areas, you know, for some biomass production or some harvest of grasslands. You know, there are going to be situations where that's going to work well, you know, with our habitat management. There are questions about the timing of the cut, the height of the remaining grass, those kinds of things, you know, and what the production is going to be. And it may differ site to site. One example for just to consider, for example, you know, a mid-season cut, mid-summer cut may be important if you want residual cover to come up to have some winter cover, or if you want to have enough fuel because you're going to do a controlled burn or a prescribed burn the next spring. In the opposite situation, you know, you may want to look at a fall cut if you're in a situation where you want to do a controlled burn, but you're, for example, in an urban area or close to an urban area where you need to really be careful about what that fire looks like and your ability to control it, you may want to reduce the amount of fuel that's there. So it's, you know, it's a question of, you know, of what your goals are for that particular unit at that particular time. But I think there's, you know, there are going to be a lot of opportunities for it. In Iowa, at the Sheraton plant, a lot of the cutting that's done on the switchgrass there is done late in the season or early fall, primarily in November. On those sites, you're certainly going to have some residual cover that would be of a benefit for nesting waterfall in the spring, for at least for some species of nesting waterfall that are attracted to relatively short grasses. If you're interested in winter cover for pheasants, that November cut is not very beneficial. And so I think that, you know, you have to look at it from that standpoint. What are your management goals? What's needed within that particular area? How we can rotate it? And how can we work with landowners on it? You know, what additional financial incentives can we provide to landowners, again, to achieve perhaps multiple benefits, cutting every other year or every third year, or, again, the timing or the height of the cutting? Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have something going on in my Senate district right now, which I'm wondering if you can help me with. And I'll explain to you what it is. There's a state park that's been established south of Litchfield, north of Hutchinson, in Meeker and McLeod County, 1,200-acre state park. It's established, but no land has been purchased there yet. But in recent months, there's been meetings of people of diverse interest talking about a much larger complex, a kind of a wildlife management conservation district that surrounds this undeveloped lake that would include maybe up to 10, 15 square miles. And there's lots of lakes, wetlands, and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has got two fairly decent parcels that they've already purchased in that area. And we've had two meetings so far, and the idea is to try to pool resources, just as you're talking about, from various agencies. We've had Ducks Unlimited, Pheasants Forever, the county commissioners from two counties, township officers from two townships. The DNR is heavily involved. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has been represented. The planning and zoning people from the two counties are involved. And we're trying to figure out a way to try to preserve a broader area than just the 1,200-acre state park, but to try to bring in a much broader range of resources and to try to preserve wetlands, preserve farms that are environmentally sound, and to try to protect a broader area from urban sprawl, you might say. And this is on the edge of the eastern edge of the prairie now. It's not in the big woods, but it's on the eastern edge of the Great Plains. So we've had a meeting in September, a meeting in December, and the next meeting is coming up probably in a couple of weeks to try to flesh this out a little bit more. And basically what they want is they want me to come up with some legislation to provide some money to figure out how to make this all work and plan this larger complex. And so what you've been talking about today kind of fits in exactly with what we're thinking about trying to do. So I'm just wondering, is there some way that I could get you to come and talk to this group or provide some advice or maybe get you directly involved in trying to make this thing really work out?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, I mean, you know, I certainly would be more than willing to do that. We have other personnel who are working with this program as well, but I'm sure we can accommodate that.
Thank you. We do need to move along as well. I want to thank Ray Norgaard and Dave Shad for being here today. Appreciate the information.
Thank you.
Next on our agenda today is a presentation on sustainable agriculture. Tom Peterson with the Minnesota Farmers Union is here, and Tom will give you the table. Also with him is Mary Jo Forbird, Executive Director of Sustainable Farming Association, I believe.
That's the motto.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tom Peterson. I'm the Director of Government Relations with the Minnesota Farmers Union, and thank you for the opportunity to talk for a few minutes about some of the issues in sustainable agriculture and kind of what sustainable agriculture might be. I also do have with me Mary Jo Forbard, and she's the executive director of the Sustainable Farming Association. It's probably one of the hardest questions that I get asked in my job is, what is sustainable agriculture, and what farm is and isn't a sustainable farm? Because that you can go round and round about that. But in the Minnesota Farmers Union, it's important to recognize that I represent the full spectrum of farmers, from organic, maybe natural producers with low inputs, to traditional row crop and livestock farmers, to those who partner with large corporate entities to produce what they produce. I provided you a copy of our organic and sustainable policies just to kind of peruse that, you know, to kind of see some of the, you know, issues that we support and don't support for sustainable agriculture. And our basic definition of sustainable agriculture is that it's good for the farm and the family, it's good for the community, and it's good for the environment. And that those are kind of the three parameters that we follow. Very broad, I understand. I also want to mention that a lot of times when we talk about sustainable agriculture, we mention organic farming. Organic farming gets intertwined with sustainable farming, and many times rightly so, but a sustainable farmer is not always organic, and a lot of our farmers will tell us that organic farmers aren't always sustainable. So it's, you know, something else to ponder. And I mention that too because I do serve as chair of the state organic task force that advises Commissioner Hugesson on organic farming issues, and that's a real emerging trend. And so when we talk about sustainable agriculture, it's a very important that we have those opportunities. So I just mentioned those three things that I talked about. So for the family and the farm itself, it has to be sustainable first as a profit. You know, as a venture. So if you're going to go into farming and you're going to raise, or an organic dairy, or you're going to go into an energy venture, or you're going to do a grass-fed beef operation, it has to be sustainable to your pocketbook. It has to be cash flow. You have to be able to make money at it, and you have to get a good farm gate price. Otherwise, you're not doing it. And I always think the bank's interested in that, too. And that's an important part of this discussion. The next part I always say is when we're talking about it's good for the community, we talk a lot about buying local and where your dollars flow and that we provide good support to the community. And right now you'll hear a lot of talk, too, about local foods, niche marketing, direct marketing. We see a huge growth in that. A lot of our farmers are direct marketing their beef, their pasture chickens, whatever. That's exciting. We see a huge growth in food co-ops and people buying food in food co-ops. The Wedge Co-op in Minneapolis has 11,000 members and is still growing very strong. And they buy a lot of food locally from our farmers that's produced maybe what we'll call sustainable or organic. Farmers Union, I provided you a copy of our calendar we've put out with some other partners that features a lot of our farmers that grow a lot of different organic, sustainable type products. We do this event at the State Fair every year called the Taste of Tuesday Minnesota Cooks, where we feature farmers, the direct market, and celebrity chefs from the area that market. But for the purpose of this committee, I'd like to talk about the environment and what sustainable farming a lot of times means to the environment. And, you know, it's important a lot of times for those farmers that are transitioning into a sustainable farm, again, or a sustainable practice. And what that might be is, but not always limited to, is expanding a grazing operation, maybe from a feedlot type operation, maybe going to a low or no-till operation like we saw kind of on the video, where you're not tilling the soil as much and you're leaving more cover. You're using low inputs in your farming, so you're not using as much pesticides, herbicides, or commercial fertilizer. You're maybe using a third crop or a cover crop. And all these things help, like, in highly erodible lands. They help in conservation practices such as ditch buffers that you're going to be talking about sometime in this committee, buffer strips, contour strip farming, terracing. These are all methods that are a lot of times associated with this that help slow runoff and ease a lot of the concerns that this committee's heard in the past and will hear in the future. Whether it's the, I spent 3 years now, at least 3 years, as part of this G16 that put together the Clean Water Legacy. And these are important pieces of that and will continue to be important pieces of that if the with the buffers and the different incentives for that. And also it helps expand habitats and restore wetlands. And finally, I want to mention, too, that, well, two things. One, we strongly support programs that the state does have for sustainable farming through the University of Minnesota. I also passed out a brochure for, it's called MISA, Minnesota Institute for Sustainable Agriculture, that's housed in the University of Minnesota. The legislature funds that, and different committees will be considering funding for that. And you'll hear maybe from Mary Hanks with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture here about the sustainable programs that they have that help our farmers. And our policy is to support those programs for those farmers that choose to enter into those practices. They're very important. It's good to have that resource. If you're going to go away from a corn and bean type situation or we're going to want to get into this, you got to have help and information. It makes it a lot easier. And our state has always invested in that. But I want to mention that we have cut those programs significantly in the last 4 years because of budget deficits. And so we're always encouraging the committee to consider the merits of those programs as we try to bring some of those bills forward. Finally, I want to mention the last thing that I think is kind of interesting, as exciting as all the talk is about switchgrass, and that was a great presentation. You can see we're part of the DNR working lands and having incentives for that, and we're going to have to work out a lot of those things with the energy. Farmers Union also has instituted a carbon credit program that allows producers and landowners to earn income by storing carbon in their soil through what I would argue are sustainable practices of using no-till crop production and long-term grass seeding. We just started this program this fall. We're in the process of buying credits from our farmers that we'll be trading this next month on the Chicago Climate Exchange. And I think that is something, too, that this committee will probably deal with at some point that looks at some other types of farming methods and rewarding farmers for those. So that's just a brief snapshot of some of the issues, kind of how we define sustainable agriculture and some of the things we're working on. Thank you.
Mr. Peterson, back home at a recent meeting, there was a question brought up about a $25,000 revolving loan fund that people who are interested in getting involved in sustainable farming can access. And the question became, is that enough? And I guess my question is, are people accessing that? And are they using that sustainable farming fund?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Mary Hanks is here with the Department of Agriculture, and maybe if she's going to talk briefly, she could address that or would know for sure on that. And we hope so, because that's something we've been working on. I would mention, too, to all of you that the Rural Finance Authority that administers some of these loans and everything is out of money, and we need to pass a bonding bill, a bonding request for them to authorize the sell bonds as soon as possible. So.
Questions? Senator Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to ask, while you're talking about organics, what you think about the impact of the huge companies like Walmart getting into the organic marketplace. What impact will that have on our organic or sustainable farmers? A good one or a bad one? Or, I mean, for consumers, it probably means lower prices, but what does it mean overall?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Anderson, that's a really interesting question that we deal with a lot. In Minnesota, we have about 5,000 dairy farmers. About 100 are organic. As I understand, about 50 more are in transition. We have a shortage of organic milk. And if the mailbox price today for a conventional dairy farmer, my next-door neighbor, he gets a little over $13. The farmers that are farming organically are getting about $26, $27 a hundredweight. Now, and Senator Dill, and we can talk, you know, about what their production, what they put into it is different. But there is a market there. And the exciting thing is that Walmart, for example, has had to cancel their contracts with the supplier because they can't get enough organic milk in certain cases. And so the interesting thing there is that the demand's there. So are we going to step up and have policies that, get more farmers into
and fill that need, you know, or are the big companies and everything going to jump in there and say, you know, hey, we can't get our production from our family farmers and our whatever, our farmers, we need to get it on a much larger scale. And that is happening to a point. So we're arguing, and we'll be arguing at the legislature this year for some bills to help promote that. Unfortunately, Walmart, and we would debate that maybe in another committee another time, that does drive a lower cost price. I would just mention, too, when our task force toured Lunds and Byerly's this summer with Commissioner Hugesson, the conventional milk was $2.69 a gallon. It was full at the Lunds. The organic milk, $6.29 a gallon, was empty. And he said, we're out of milk. It'll be 2 days before our supplier is able to get us any. So that really showed me the need, and we're working to fill that. So, sorry. Long answer.
Other questions from the committee? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay. Members of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity to talk with you today about sustainable agriculture. My name is Mary Jo Forbord. I am the executive director of the Sustainable Farming Association of Minnesota, which is a nonprofit organization that has been in existence since 1988. It has 9 active chapters throughout the state of Minnesota, and I am the first executive director, having served in this capacity since the year 2003. The mission of the Sustainable Farming Association of Minnesota is to support the development and enhancement of sustainable farming systems through innovation, demonstration, education, and farmer-to-farmer networking. Our goals include the mentorship and encouragement of farmers, especially the next generation of farmers. Another goal of the Sustainable Farming Association of Minnesota is to enhance and expand our information network among our members, our chapters, and the public. Another goal is to, with our many collaborators across the state, to research, market, and promote sustainable agriculture practices and products. We are increasing farmer participation and profitability in the rapidly developing and expanding community-based food systems appearing throughout Minnesota and our nation and internationally. And the final goal is to inform and educate consumers about healthy food and farming practices that yield a diverse array of sustainably produced food, fiber, and energy. I am a farmer from Western Minnesota. I'm a fifth-generation farmer. My husband is also a fifth-generation farmer. Every ancestor that we have been farmers. There's one farmer left on my side of the family, my brother, and we are it for my husband's side of the family. So I have a real affinity for farming. I grew up on a farm. I left the farm to get a degree in nutrition, which, of course, is related to farming. Not everybody might remember that, but it's certainly very related to farming, and spent 20 years in healthcare, living on a farm, working with my husband. In 1998, because of nutrition not still fitting very well in our healthcare system, I left healthcare and milked full-time with my husband until 2002, when what we thought was a sustainable lifestyle became not that sustainable because of the price of commodity milk. At that time, we sold our Holstein cows and bought a type of breed that does very well on grass and converted row crops into grass-based farming, and we have just completed many miles of fence line and now have certified our farm, our pasture lands organic, and market directly to consumers. We live in a unique area of Minnesota. Much of the prairie terrain looked very familiar to me, and also the Working Lands Initiative. We find ourselves in the central area of one of those Working Lands Initiatives on the ground, looking at working lands from a different perspective. I appreciate that you're wrestling with all of us about the definition for sustainable farming. I hope you didn't think that I was going to bring you the ultimate definition today. I, in fact, like Tom's definition, and if you go on the internet, you could probably find about 2,000 more definitions of sustainable farming. The reason being that sustainable farming is indeed a dynamic progression. If we know what it is now in this place, it will change over time depending on external impacts and internal changes. Just as nature is a dynamic process, sustainable farming being a system is also a dynamic process. However, There are the three principles that Tom mentioned, the economic, the environmental, and social justice principles, which are very interactive in a sustainable farming system. One of the major misconceptions that I find is people are continually trying to find out who's in, who's out, what's sustainable, what's not, where even the most experienced sustainable farmers will tell you they are on a progression. As we saw in the history of the land, sometimes it's not very evident what's not sustainable until the ball game's pretty much over. And our task, all of us, is to peer from our lessons of the history into the future, where things become very much more uncertain, and try to chart a course about what a sustainable agriculture looks like. In Minnesota, across three biomes, it's going to look different on my farm than it does on Senator Dill's farm or anyone else's farm in this state. It's not a soundbite sort of concept, but it does have those principles and is also based on diversity and decentralization. A definition that we might consider is that it has a capacity to produce without depleting the resource base. I mentioned the goals of producing food, fiber, and energy. Energy is consuming a lot of the discussion, so I'll leave that to discussions of renewable energy and biomass, which we are very much interested in and involved in. Sustainable farmers also tend to be resource conservationists, and turn the brief time that I have to the discussion of our food system in Minnesota and what is happening, and the reason that we can take a shot at being a sustainable farmer in this environment is only because of consumers that are becoming more conscious of how we consume, what we consume. If you think about our food system, it really drives lots of what you see on the land, and it really drives lots of what our health consists of. And those are things that they're starting to become more connected. The reason I became a dietitian and a nutritionist was because of the central role that nutrition plays in health. And more people are tracing that back to where our food comes from and the diversity that we are designed to eat as humans and to stay as a healthy population. So the idea with sustainable farming is not to homogenize a very diverse landscape, but rather harmonize and play into the diversity that is more resilient. We understand this with portfolios in the stock market, that sort of thing. We aren't putting all of our money into one speculative stock, and I think that's always a point when many of us become rather cautious when we say, okay, here's the ticket, here's the bandwagon. This is sometimes nature has a trump card to play, and if we only have one suit, then we're in trouble. And what sustainable farming tries to do is to spread our risks a good bit, and especially take our cues from the land. There's many more things that I would like to talk with you about today, but we do have colleagues who have important things to say, and I want to be affording of their time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Question, Senator Deal?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'd just like to personally welcome Mary Jo Forbord to the committee here. She and I worked together for two or three years on various farm issues, and we also she was nice enough to come to my farm last July 1st, where we had a sustainable farming tour of my 640-acre crop and livestock farm. She moderated a panel discussion we had there on agriculture, and I want to thank you publicly for coming and taking time to do that.
Other questions? Others in the audience today that would like to speak to this committee? Keeping in mind we have about 15 minutes left, I appreciate that.
While she's coming
Senator
up,
Anderson?
I just have to make an editorial comment. I'm looking at the calendar, and September talks about Carleton College and how they have this new project to use sustainable, locally grown food from the region in the cafeteria. Well, when I was a student there, let's see, almost 30 years ago, I worked for Saga, the food service, and boy, these kids are lucky. That's all I can say. You know, I can tell you stories about the kind of food we used to eat in the cafeteria.
I don't, Senator Anderson, do we want to know that?
No, you don't want to know where the scrambled eggs came from a car.
Senator Shadrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson. I can only hope that that food comes from the St. Olaf's side of North.
Not this rivalry. Oh, I forgot who, Mr. Chair. I forgot who's the chair of this committee. Sorry about that.
I apologize. You'll have to do a self-introduction. Sure. So, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mary Hanks. I manage the Sustainable Agriculture Program at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I also live in Northfield and am very aware of the St. Olaf-Carleton rivalry as well as all the good things that they're doing with energy. And I know St. Olaf has they grow some of their own food for their cafeteria right there on St. Olaf's property. So both colleges are doing a great job. I'm not going to take very much of your time. I just wanted to make sure that you are aware that there is a sustainable agriculture program at the department. It was begun in 1989 as part of the groundwater protection bill and has been operating relatively smoothly for the last so many years. We have a number of different programs. We have the Sustainable Ag Loan Program, which was started in 1988 with $1 million fund. It's a revolving fund, to answer your question, Mr. Chair. The fund balance is healthy right now. We don't get too many loans. We just haven't done, honestly, a good enough job of getting it promoted and out there. We are doing a better job the last couple of years. Since we lowered the interest rate to 3%, it's much more attractive. It's a very good program. It helps farmers purchase equipment, make changes for energy production, energy savings, dairy upgrades, a number of different things, buying tillage equipment that may not be as accepted as some of the conventional practices, and it gives them a little incentive to try some new things. But I do believe we have plenty of money right now, and we just need to get it out there. I'd be happy to send you some additional information to get to your constituents.
I guess one of my questions was, is the cap too low? Is it not attractive to them?
Mr. Chairman, we raised the cap from 15 to 25 about 5 years ago. I've not heard too much that the cap is too low.
Okay.
But if you have some constituents that would be more interested, I'm sure I could go back to the department and we could come forward with something to raise it.
Thank you.
Other programs, just very quickly, we have a Sustainable Ag Grant Program, and I did bring copies of the we do an annual report of all those programs. These are grants to farmers to try innovative things like cover crops, grazing, value-added direct marketing projects, energy, just about anything you can think of. It's just to encourage them to try some things to reduce some of the risk. We also have cover cropping programs. We have a staff person who does rotational grazing plans for farmers, again, trying to get some of that land back to mimic the prairie system that you saw in the film, and to get the animals rotating and moving through that, much like some of the native herd animals. I've got lots more to say, too, just like Mary Jo did. But also at the department, not all of the sustainable agriculture support is within my program. I'd like to just remind you, too, about the Minnesota Grown Program in the marketing division that does a great job helping Minnesota farmers, many sustainable and organic farmers, direct market their meat, eggs, produce, honey, just about anything you can think of. And there's a growing support in the Food, Dairy, and Meat Inspection Service to help farmers with on-farm processing and food safety and direct marketing areas. So the sustainable activities in the department are growing, and I think will continue to grow. In addition, we also have integrated pest management and biological control programs to help farmers reduce pesticide use, make better use of pesticides, and take advantage of some of those natural enemies to combat invasive species that were also mentioned, I think, as part of the Working Lands initiative. I would hope that we could be invited back at some point where we might go through a little more in detail with you about what we do, and certainly with Sustainable Farming Association and some other groups. I just thank you for this opportunity.
Question, Senator Stumpf?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When you said what did you say, invasive?
Invasive species. Weeds.
I was thinking more of the Asian beetle, which has become a big pest. And I believe it was brought into this country for research on how to get rid of the soybean aphids. Well, it's turned out that I think that has become a much greater problem than the soybean aphids. There's different ways of getting rid of them, but these Asian beetles are unbelievable. They're all over the place, and they smell, and they bite, and they just seem like they multiply in air.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Stumpf, the Asian beetle was actually brought in, I believe, for a pecan pest, to control a pecan pest in the southeastern United States, and never really took there, and they're not completely sure how it established itself after that, probably on soybean aphids. Actually, this year I've had more trouble with box elder bugs than the Asian lady beetles. I can't seem to get rid of those. But they are a pest, and you know, as you look at different strategies for managing pests, you have to be careful that you don't create another nuisance. I did forget to mention that we have an organic program. I didn't bring my notes up. I thought I was only going to have a couple of minutes, but we have an organic program. It's very, very successful. We work with farmers to increase the number of organic dairy farms. I've handed out the organic conference program. That's coming up a week from Friday. We get about 300 to 350 people. The trade show is 60 vendors. It's full this year. We have a waiting list and about 40 speakers. And if I know it's during session, but it'd be great to have some people attend that at some point, just to see the excitement, the young farmers coming in, and just enjoying learning from each other.
Very good. Senator Stumpf.
Mr. Chairman, just one other follow-up, just so I think members, the definition of organic, if you could just refresh our memories, and you know, I was under the impression that there was some leeway there, but the standard is quite high, isn't it, in terms of if you're going to, let's say, actually raise an organic crop, the limitations are very stringent.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Stumpf, the requirements for organic production are set by the USDA, the National Organic Program. Those standards are set at the federal level. They are very stringent. Reduces your ability to use pesticides and most fertilizers except for animal manures, compost, green manures, no hormones in livestock production, antibiotics are excluded. You're supposed to treat your animals, but if they're sick, but they need then to be removed from the operation. There are requirements for crop rotation, for managing, for water quality, soil conservation, wildlife. It's pages and pages of requirements just for the farmer. And then there are also requirements for processing and handling.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Chaudhry, what's your pleasure? Anyone else that wanted to see the committee? For new people, and I guess right now, Senator Ingebrigtsen, it's just you and I, we should leave our brown files here, and somebody will take care of them.
Okay.
The senior senators know that. Some of us newer ones don't, but leave those.
We're starting to accumulate pretty well, actually.
Yes. Yeah. And I want to thank those who gave their time today and took the time to be here with us. Do we have a next scheduled meeting yet, Senator Chaudhry?
Next Wednesday
at
same time.
All right. Anything else from the committee? We stand adjourned. Thank you.
ATV. It's the third episode of the ATV presentation.